Adam Chartoff, your host of Foam Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 406. Well, I just came off of a break. I wasn't self-imposed, actually, because I didn't think, oh, I'm burnt out, let me take off 2 weeks. What happened was that my partner's Rooftop Films redesigned their website, and there was just this period of time that it took to kind of work out all the wrinkles, all the little necessary steps in order to get the podcast working. And there's still some more to do, but essentially we're now back. And I apologize for not warning everybody, but we are back in business here. We got tons and tons of content ready to go. I'm very excited. This episode is dedicated to the recent 2017 Tribeca Film Festival. I did these interviews. They're relatively brief compared to some shows. They run in length from 10 to 20 minutes, and I did a series of four different interviews from the festival, and they include the following folks returning to the podcast. Well, most of these people are returning to the podcast, though not all of my guests are returning to the podcast. We have Oren Moverman, who is back with a new film called The Dinner, which stars Richard Gere. Also in the cast is Laura Linney, Chloe Sevigny, Steve Coogan, and Rebecca Hall. And Oren was on a couple of years ago with the film A Time Out of Mind, which also starred Richard Gere. And this is terrific. It's great to have Oren back on the show. He is definitely somebody who I really enjoy speaking with. Also coming back is Film Wax Radio friend Joe Berlinger returns to the podcast. He has a new film called Intent to Destroy about the Armenian genocide that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century and that very few people really know about. And that's partly the reason why the documentary is made. How come that is the case? You know, Joe Berlinger, back in the day, he used to co-direct documentaries with the late Bruce Sanofsky. They made the Paradise Lost trilogy, which included Paradise Lost, the child murders at Robin Hood Hills, Paradise Lost 2, Revelations, and I guess a few years back, they finished the trilogy following the release of the West Memphis 3 with Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory. Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky had, before even that trilogy, made a movie, which is a classic called Brother's Keeper. But since Bruce has passed away, Joe has gone on to make films on his own, including the Maurice and Tony Robbins' I Am Not Your Guru, and now and also the TV series Judgment Day, Prison or Parole, and Killing Richard Glossop. It seems as though Joe is very interested in, since the days of Paradise Lost, in the topic of exoneration, which thank goodness. So he's back here to discuss his new documentary. Coming up also on this episode, a conversation with the young filmmaker Danielle Katvin. And I had showed a short of hers in my film series many years ago, so it was great to see that she had a short called The Foster Portfolio at Tribeca. And I saw it and enjoyed it very much and talked to Danielle on the podcast. And lastly, if that weren't enough, those three different guests we have on, two more people. Josephine Decker returns to the podcast with her co-star and co-director, Zephry Threwell, who together they have a new film called Flames, which you have to see to believe. So it's a very packed show, and I'm very excited to be back in the swing of things. So without hesitation, let's go into my first conversation with it, which is with Danielle Katvin and her short, The Foster Portfolio. All right, so once again, take two, Danielle Katvin on Film Wax Radio, finally, after years. But you can say that you were on Film Wax in a screening, because I used to do a screening series.
That's right, my short film, Laundry.
And you were living, that's right, mm-hmm. And you were living in L.A. at the time,
Yeah, I lived in L.A. at the time and then came back to Brooklyn, and now I'm floating between the two coasts.
You are?
I am, yeah.
You're, as they used to say in the 80s, bicoastal.
Bicoastal, nomad, one or the other.
Oh, yeah? I guess that's nice.
It's okay. It has its ups and downs. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I just need to go wherever the work is, and
sure,
it happens everywhere. So
right, exactly. Do you shoot for other people? Or are
no.
you what's or do you what or director for hire or do you...
I direct and then I'm cut. Also I also edit.
Edit.
Yeah.
That seems
yeah,
to
I be. Edited the Foster portfolio.
The Foster portfolio, what is that? Well, since we're on the subject of that's your short.
That's my short that had its world premiere at Tribeca.
Congratulations.
Tribeca Film Festival last week. Uh-huh. We've had 3 screenings so far, uh-huh. One more tomorrow.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, it's too bad this isn't live. I have to, you know, figure out how to do a live stream, and then we can promote yeah. on the fly, you know, in real time. So it's called the Foster Portfolio, which is portfolio is one's financial portfolio,
correct?
Investments, that type of thing. I guess it looks has the look of something that takes place in the maybe the 50s or
it
60s,
is, yeah.
Right?
We have
Mad
it
Men
as
era.
1951.
Oh, 51. Yeah. Okay, so
which
it's post-war.
Exactly.
Mad Men era.
And it's the same year that Vonnegut, it's based
Kurt
on a short
Vonnegut.
Story by
That's
Kurt
right.
Vonnegut.
Oh, I'm glad you keep reminding me of that, because he was one of my favorites growing up.
Oh, mine too.
And, really?
Oh, yeah. I love his work. And he wrote the story in 1951 for Collier's Magazine.
Is that right?
And I found it in his collection of short stories, Welcome to the Monkey House.
Mm-hmm. And it's never been adapted before, to your knowledge?
Actually, I think in the early 90s, they had a TV series called Kurt Vonnegut's Monkey House on Showtime, where they did adaptations of several of the short stories from the book, and this was one of them. John Cryer actually played the young investment advisor.
Wow.
And I never saw it. I didn't want to be influenced by it.
Right. You should send this to John Cryer.
I should.
Yeah. You know, maybe he'll EP your next film.
Yeah, maybe.
Because he's a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
After doing that show for about 20 years or something.
It was a process getting permission to adapt it in the first place.
Oh, did you have to go to the Vonnegut Estate or something?
I did,
or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was about 7 years ago. I was still in film school at the time.
Really? This has been in development for 7
years? Oh, my God. It took 5 years to get them to agree to it.
I would have done, at that point, a miniseries or, like, you know, like, feature, even though it's a short story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like, finally get permission after years, and
I know.
You may as well really go with, run with it, you know?
Yeah, well, I think in order to be able to do a feature, we would have had to negotiate a little bit differently.
I see.
But it took, I reached out to the estate about 7 years ago, was immediately shot down, and spent the next 5 years just harassing them.
Really?
With emails and phone calls. And
so how long between your first no did you, or was it before you decided, well, let me give this another shot? Because that can be, a lot of people would be probably... at that point, terrified to,
yeah,
or
I don't
to,
know.
Too intimidated to
I don't
try to
remember how often
lobby.
I reached out, but it was just every so often over the course of 5 years, and then eventually, when I moved back to New York, I met with them in person, brought a bottle of wine, and I think that's kind of what helped. They were just sick of me by the end of it. They were like, "Just go make the movie and leave us alone." So.
That's nice. Well, now you have a method for a strategy.
Yeah, wine fixes
wine
everything.
Always, right, of course. Nothing like a nice Sancerre to ease your way into someone's good graces.
Indeed.
Okay, so again, the short is about, I don't know if it's a comedy, but it certainly has the elements of a comedy. A lot of irony in it.
That's
where
Vonnegut's
right.
voice.
Oh, very, very true. It has Vonnegut's voice to it, exactly. Well said. So, and it's about a couple who are struggling financially, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. You know, they live very, very lower middle class, if that, right? And then, so they invite this young hotshot accountant
right
to come over.
Well, the husband does.
The
wife,
husband,
yeah.
Right. The husband, is, since you brought it up, right, he believes that the subject of money shouldn't be discussed or involve a woman. Or is he just trying to keep her, it's sort of his this information secret?
I think, he doesn't want her to know about the, basically he's got this inheritance that was left to him by his grandfather that was, that's worth, you know, today it would be, you know, like $30 million. At the time it was $1 million. Maybe it would be less, like $15 million. But
no, it'll be enough to set you up.
To set you up for life.
Yeah.
As the investment counselor says in the story, you know, bourbon, nice cars, silk underwear, winters in Florida, all the things that he would want in his own life. But he is keeping this inheritance a secret from his wife, because if she knew that he had all this money, it would uncover a double life that he's living.
Oh, right, right, right. But I don't want to talk about that. Okay. Because, well, I don't mind referring to a double life. That's right. Good. But you don't want to say what it is.
No, no, no. I wouldn't want to reveal anything beyond that. But I think, you know,
right. Enough that to just... That he's a cross-dresser. No, he's not.
That would have been much more interesting.
No.
No, I'm just
No,
kidding.
You set it up really well.
Thank you.
It's a very... the last scene is very... very entertaining, in fact, yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, again, it's called The Foster Portfolio. The Foster, of course, is the couple's name.
Correct.
And, so do you have more festivals set up yet, or is it... Tribeca's good.
Yeah,
so.
we just found out another festival we're not allowed to announce publicly.
Got
which
it.
One.
Okay, do you want me to wait?
No, it's fine.
On that?
I mean, it's up to you.
Okay, I don't know. How many shorts have you made now, Danielle?
Three.
Three. Oh, okay, very good.
Yeah, my very first short film I did back when I was in film school.
Yes.
We shot it for $200 on a Panasonic HVX. It was just an exercise, a conversation between two people in a roadside motel. And that one actually ended up winning an award from Kodak, which was really exciting. We got an award for excellence in the craft of filmmaking a film company, even though we shot on a digital camera.
Yeah, right.
And then the second one was Laundry, which you saw, which also did very well and played in several festivals, Palm Springs and San Francisco International and LA Shorts. And this is my third. And the reason I decided to do another short film was because I felt that I wanted to tackle a longer narrative, something that felt more like a feature in short form, to kind of prove to myself that it was something that I could handle and something that I could do before diving into a longer form project.
Right.
And I think it went well. So I'm looking forward to now doing more features and television.
Are you thinking about doing a feature?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm in development on a couple of concepts actually, as well as episodic.
Uh-huh.
But I'm also looking for scripts and stories to adapt all the time. I don't feel that I necessarily have to write everything that I direct. Although I've done that up until now, and I'm happy to continue to do that. But I would love to find a story or a script that I can also just bring my vision to, something that inspires me.
Since we were on the subject of adapting, this obviously was a Vonnegut short, a short story. Was that daunting at all, or did it lend itself to the screen? I guess the earlier production is proof that to some degree it must, but...
It definitely was daunting.
That,
yeah. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to see what they did.
Smart.
I wanted to do it my own way. And it's tough because the story is written in the first person internal monologue from the perspective of the narrator.
Right.
So there's so much going on in his head, which makes it difficult to translate. I did end up keeping a little bit of voiceover in the story because I wanted it to have that kind of literary feel and kind of pay homage?
I think they're both
homage
acceptable.
To Vonnegut's words. And also it felt like a good fit stylistically with the films of that time period and the kind of noir feel of the mystery. And a lot of the dialogue is the original dialogue. I tried to stay very true to the story. And I think the most exciting part was capturing Vonnegut's tone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, as you said, ironic kind of dark humor.
Yeah.
And it felt for me when I read the story that it really resonated with my sensibilities as a filmmaker to kind of build this world and create an aesthetic and a tone that really fit with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that was, you know, when I thought about how is this going to look and when I thought about directing it, that was what I had in mind.
Mm-hmm. Who are the actors in this?
So the lead is the narrator, the young investment counselor, is Ro Hartramp. And he's had like small parts in shows like Boardwalk Empire, I can't even remember right now off the top of my head.
And much more.
IMDb him. He's wonderful. and Joel Nagel plays Herbert Foster. And I actually found him through another short film that I was watching, and I called him into audition. And he was Herbert immediately. It was amazing. At first I was going for... My inspiration for the character was somebody like Michael Shannon.
I was just thinking of Michael Shannon.
Yeah, that's who I had in mind. And
well, I could see that.
A lot of people have told me that he reminds them of Michael Shannon, which is so funny
because... Well, it's that quiet, you know, sort of just below the surface, the boiling below the surface. Kind of like that kind of, you know, where you can tell there's something going on. Yeah, yeah.
But it's funny because when he first came in, I was like, oh, he's too, like, handsome. Like, he doesn't look weird. I wanted somebody kind of funny looking. And then the moment he started performing, his eyes just kind of went crazy. And I was like, this is even better because he looks so, you know, put together on the surface. And then when he performs, there's this something coming through underneath, which is exactly what you want.
Right.
And he embodied the idea of Michael Shannon, even though I didn't think it was going to be the case. And then Alma, his wife, is played by Rebecca Watson. She's also had, you know, several roles in lots of different TV shows that you know.
A lot of TV out there. I mean, there's so much television work now. You know, there's a lot of opportunities for actors now.
Absolutely.
Whereas, like, I don't know, like almost 10 years ago, that it ran out because, as I like to say, because, you know, there wasn't quite the level of how every network had tons of TV shows. For a long time, it was like reality. There was nothing but reality television on, it seemed like, for about, 10 years. And a lot of actors couldn't get work. Seriously. And then a lot of that's been finally replaced again because now every channel has original programming. Right. And, of course, as we know, there are a lot of now online platforms.
Totally.
That have a lot of...
There's so much content out there.
So much. Anyway, so the name again is The Foster Portfolio. It's going to be playing one more time. By the time this is up, though, I have a feeling you will have only yourself to blame for not having seen Danielle Cadvan's short. And so on to developing a feature, you said?
Indeed.
Okay. Yeah. So hopefully in the next couple of years we can expect a feature from you.
I hope so, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome back anytime. So when you have something else, I'll look forward to seeing that and we'll have you back on.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Danielle, and I do hope to bring her back when she has her feature. That would be terrific. Okay, up here, FilmWax Radio Friend. And by the way, I did years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, host a 20th anniversary screening of Brother's Keeper with Joe Berlinger. We did it at the now defunct 92nd Street Y Tribeca to a sold-out crowd. Bruce Sanofsky wasn't there, unfortunately. And, of course, I found out he was too sick to join us, and he would later pass away not too long after. Sadly, Bruce was a great guy. But Joe is with me, and I hope this is the first of a couple conversations about recent work Joe has done. He has already agreed to come back yet another time, so I'm always happy to bring on Joe Berlinger. He makes great documentaries. Let's get to it right now. The name of the film is Intent to Destroy, coming soon to a theater, but still in the festival circuit.
Is it bad that I have a little candy in my mouth?
No, I think a tuna sandwich would have been worse, something like that. You know what? We're going to talk about the fact that we're here at Tribeca, where Intent to Destroy, full title is...
Well, you know, there is a subtitle, but we're not...
Yeah, okay.
You know, when you watch, the subtitle is is Death, Denial, and Depiction, but...
Okay, yeah, it's an upbeat...
The cheery...
Way to
the
go.
Whole film's very cheery. You know?
Well, okay, not everything's supposed to be cheery. Sometimes you have to deliver the not-so-cheery news, too.
I'm kidding. You know, people were a little worried about me after the Tony Robbins film, because it was upbeat and
yeah,
positive.
Right. So. You were. By the time this gets to the movie screens, it'll probably be called ITD, or, you know, like, you know how they like acronyms now instead of whole names. You joke about delivering bad news, but the truth is that I'm sure there are a lot of Armenians who are very happy about this film.
I mean, the Armenian community obviously is very happy. You know, I think this is the first film that really just comprehensively goes through and makes it understandable, not just what the genocide is, because there have been, or was, you know, the facts of the genocide, because I think there have been several other, you know, good documentaries about that. But I think what, you know, makes this film, I think, particularly relevant and different from what's been done in the past is that the film is also about denial.
Denial.
The mechanism of denial, the aftermath of denial, and takes us up right through the present day, which I think is incredibly important because we live in a world of, you know, alternative facts, fake news, lack of accountability, very siloed media world where we all tune into the opinions that we want to hear. Objectivity is hard to come by. One could argue that this film is not objective. We can talk about that later. I think, you know, the sweeping under the rug of the Armenian genocide by Western interests that want to appease Turkey, you know, is one of the great moral outrages of the past century. And I think it's very, it's an important cautionary tale for today as we move into an environment where facts and accountability don't seem to matter as much as they used to.
Absolutely true. As busy as you are, you probably don't get a chance to see too many documentaries, but I just came out of seeing another documentary this morning called Acorn, which, you know, by Sam Pollard and Ruben Atlas. And in a very, very, very different way, it also deals with alternative facts. And the late Andrew Breitbart plays a role in the story and the decline of that organization. But getting back to Intent to Destroy, I just want to let people know that, first of all, I hope this is the first of two conversations about this project and other stuff you do. So when the film comes out theatrically, we can talk about more about it. But the backdrop of this documentary is the making of a narrative film.
Yes.
Starring
Christian Bale. Oscar Isaac and Charlotte Rabban and Angela Sarafian.
Okay. There is a real Armenian actor in there, too. It's a very international cast, actually, which is one of the... There are two passages... I got to not forget to talk about that. Really drew me into the story on a whole other level. One was the scene of the movie within the movie, which is, again, The Promise, right? That's the name of the movie, which is about this genocide that we're talking about, where there is a scene where the character played by Oscar Isaac walks into the woods up to this riverbank, I think it is, and he discovers not only his family, but just
the entire village has been massacred,
and they're all laying there with extras, and it's a harrowing scene, and there's a moment where one of the great actresses, and I'm going to, of course, forget her name at the moment, but she's...
Shireh Agdaloushan.
Well, she's a magnificent actress. I've seen her in so many things over the years.
I mean,
she's like a...
The Stoning of Sariah M., which is a film that never got its due. She's just absolutely brilliant in.
There's that scene where Oscar Isaac's character, who plays an Armenian Turk, I guess, or just Armenian? Armenian.
He's an Armenian living under the Ottoman Empire.
Right, which is Turkish... owned.
Well, the Ottoman Empire was the precursor to Turkey. Modern-day Turkey.
Right, and much more. Anyway, the Armenians are treated like trash. They're looked at as second-class citizens. And anyway, so they're being cleansed out of the Ottoman Empire.
They're being murdered.
Murdered. And
and sent away. Some, you know, the forced marches, deportations.
Yeah.
And outright, you know, massacres.
The other one, Adam Egoyan... He's one of the talking heads in the film, and he starts telling about how when he made Ararat, his own take on the same story, he was being pressured in no subtle terms by, again, Turkish
interests.
And so
now he,
it's incredible.
Adam Egoyan's a Canadian filmmaker, as hopefully people know. First of all, we should talk about why I chose, because it relates to Adam, you know, why I chose to embed with The Promise as a way of making a film about the Armenian genocide, because it's not gratuitous behind the scenes making of a movie.
This is not an EPK.
It's a much more serious film. And the reason is that the history in Hollywood is that anytime Hollywood has attempted to make a movie about the Armenian genocide so that the Armenians could have their Schindler's List. I mean, it's natural subject matter.
Right.
Every time Hollywood has attempted to do it, as early as 1935, for example, Irving Thalberg was going to make a movie based on the book 40 Days of Musadah, which is about a moment of resistance in the Armenian genocide. Irving Thalberg was in pre-production. Turkey learned of the movie, complained to the U.S. State Department, and the U.S. State Department twisted the arm of MGM to drop the project. And ever since then, that's been the pattern. Anytime a project kind of percolates up, it gets smacked down to the point now where Hollywood just does not want to make a movie about the Armenian genocide. So when I heard the promise was being made, which was being made with a lot of Hollywood involvement, producer Mike Medavoy, executive producer Ralph Winter, Oscar Isaac, Christian Bale.
Big names.
You know,
yeah.
Directed by Terry George. So this is a Hollywood film, but it's being funded by private interests. So it was not coming out of Hollywood, but yet it was a main, for the first time, a mainstream movie about the Armenian genocide was being made. I thought that was presented an interesting moment to make a film, a documentary about the genocide, by using the present tense thread of the making of the movie to tell not just the story of the genocide, but the underlying denial and how this story has been repressed and the aftermath of denial. Because, as they say, many, many smarter people than me have said, the final stage of genocide is denial. And so I thought by embedding with that film, I could make the story of the Armenian genocide on a practical level accessible to a 21st century audience that might not think it's relevant by, I hate to say it, the eye candy of the making of a movie, but then using that genre of behind the scenes to elevate it, to tell something deeper about not just giving the definitive history of the genocide, but to get into how denial works and how dangerous denial is, and as a cautionary tale for the world we live in today, where, you know, we play fast and loose with the truth on many, many issues. And that's, you know, what is the truth today? The cover of Time magazine, you know, recently had, you know, Truth is Dead, which was quite compelling.
It's a scary expression. I've never seen such a successful campaign erasing the Armenian genocide before. And in many ways, this was almost the template for the Holocaust that we are more familiar with that followed soon after, only maybe 20 years, if that, right? About 20 years later, at which, not to say there weren't many deniers there too, and still are, but there seems to have been a very hard pushback. Why was it so hard? Weren't there interests in the German Holocaust as well? You know, weren't there other interests in there to also deny that Holocaust? Why was this successful?
There is Holocaust denial, of course, but it's not mainstream. The problem with the Armenian genocide denial is that the denial is very mainstream.
It is mainstream.
And it's been portrayed as a contested history. I think, you know, it's because of the complicity of Western powers. You know, at the end of World War One. When the Ottoman Empire crumbled and out of those ashes rose the Republic of Turkey, the West was very eager to restore good diplomatic relations with Turkey. Turkey was, you know, in the ruins of the Ottoman Empire were lots of natural resources and oil and things like that. And I think Western powers made the decision that their economic and strategic interests in the region outweighed the moral righteousness of dealing with the genocide. So there was Western complicity. That's one factor. The other factor, I believe, is, you know, photographic evidence. There was not a ton of photographic evidence. You know, there was no denying what happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany because, you know, there were war correspondents and cameras who, you know, accompanied the liberators of the extermination camps. So I think those two factors really have, you know, allowed this thing to be swept under the rug. And complicity to this day, you know, every president, with the exception of President Trump, every president, I still have a hard time saying those words.
I haven't ever said them actually myself.
Every president, when seeking election, has courted the Armenian vote in this country and promised to be the president who uses the G word and calls it a genocide.
In the campaign.
In the campaign. And then when they get elected, they don't do it and they break that promise. I think the United States has a moral responsibility to recognize the genocide, and we still don't because we don't want to offend Turkey, because we want their Air Force bases to, you know, during the Cold War, we wanted it, you know, to be near Russia. And in this current battle against ISIS and all of our previous Middle East engagements, Turkey is just a great strategic location to have a friendly country. And one could argue, well, maybe those are good reasons, but, you know, I don't think, you know, something as heinous as a genocide should be negotiated as political capital. I mean, that's just morally repugnant. And even perhaps most significantly, you know, Israel, a country that is very complicated, and, you know, I have lots of very close Israeli friends, but it's a complicated country. You know, a country born out of the ashes of the Holocaust, I think has a special responsibility to acknowledge the Armenian genocide.
Right.
And they,
when they, I mean, I, they, I don't
they
remember.
Have, they have decided that harmonious relations with Turkey, because of its strategic importance, is more important than acknowledging this, you know, horror as a genocide. You know, they use words like massacre and, you know, civil war, people killed people, but, you know,
and they,
genocide is state-sponsored, state-planned intent to destroy, which is where
the verbiage comes from, from those.
And it's my belief that this was a genocide, and it's my belief that we should be acknowledging it.
Yeah, there's another moment in the film where one of your talking heads talks about how technically there have only been three genocides on the books, because of the definition, as though that is enough to deny that this is it was a genocide. It's crazy.
Well, one of the many.
It's like a catch-22.
Right. One of the many denial arguments is that, you know, the law, and the term genocide was coined in 1944. The law was passed in 1948, I believe, and, you know, the genocide took place in 1915. 15. So if the term didn't exist,
neither did genocide.
Neither did genocide. It wasn't a genocide.
It's a catch-22 type.
I mean, it is an interesting legal argument, whether there's legal responsibility for, you know, and my Armenian friends don't like me even saying this, but, you know, it is an interesting argument as to whether there's legal responsibility, because the law was passed later to be, you know, as an international crime against humanity, but the moral. So I'll let smarter people figure out whether there's legal responsibility, but the moral responsibility is clear.
That's undeniable. Well, you mentioned your Armenian friends. I've been following your career pretty closely since the days of Brothers Keeper, and then the Metallica, the Paradise Trilogy, and then now you've been doing a lot with exoneration-oriented documentaries and series. Where did this come from then? Where was your connection to this particular story?
Well, you know, I'm a German Jew who wasn't, you know, no German traditions at home, and we were barely Jewish. But as a teenager, I was nonetheless obsessed with the Holocaust, because I thought, well, if I lived in Germany, I would have been killed. And so that led me into a deep dive into German culture and German studies. And I was a German major in college, and I speak fluent German. And so I've spent a lot of time studying the Holocaust. And there are some interesting connections between the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust.
Sure.
And so I was always aware of that, but I never wanted to make a film about the Armenian genocide per se, because I'm not a historical filmmaker. You know, I like following stories in the present tense as they're unfolding, and you know, and the idea of doing a PBS style documentary that is predominantly talking heads and archival footage actually wasn't interesting to me. But I was introduced to the producer of this documentary named Eric Israelian by a mutual friend. We kind of hit it off. Eric is obviously Armenian. He's also the producer of The Promise, and we met and had a couple of really interesting conversations. And he was very interested in me doing a documentary, and I kept resisting because I wasn't interested in some talking head archival footage PBS style doc. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just not what I do. And then in a subsequent meeting conversation, he started revealing to me that they were doing this major epic motion picture called The Promise. I mean, Christian Bale hadn't been cast yet. It was still early days of their film. Terry George was writing the script. And that's when the light bulb went off to me. I mean, he wasn't pitching me on the approach that I took to the film. He was saying, you know, you sure you don't want to do the documentary? But, you know, we are also doing this big feature, and we think that, you know, having a documentary would be good and a feature would be good. And I said, that's when the light bulb went off. I said, well, if you let me embed with The Promise and let me tell the story of the making of The Promise, that for me would be consistent with the kind of films I make. And that for me would be a much more interesting way to tell the story, because by telling the story of the making of a historic motion picture, historic because Hollywood has never done this film before, because the Turks have always complained and the State Department always twists the arm of the Hollywood studio to drop it.
Right.
So, you know, obviously this film has talking heads and archival footage, but for me, you know, that present tense element of embedding with a film and telling the story of the, you know, not just the making of the film, but the historical importance, and getting the kinds of scenes you were referring to where Shorey, when I, you know, heard that this feature film was being made, for me, it was a device to tell this other story, you know, this greater story of the repression in Hollywood, this ability to go behind the scenes, not just for EPK purposes, but like to really get some emotional content from the actors in the film and why it was being made, how it was being made, and use that as a present tense springboard, you know, to tell this compelling story. Because then the film could rise above, you know, first of all, the EPK genre, and the last thing it is an EPK. It's a, it, you know, or behind the, rather the behind
the bonus scene, content,
the behind the scenes genre. I feel like I've greatly transcended that because I'm telling a deep and meaningful story. But most importantly, instead of just focusing on the facts of the genocide, it allowed me to talk about denial and the mechanism of denial and the aftermath of denial. And so I pitched him on that idea, and they
Well, I really appreciate it.
You know, he was not necessarily going for it, but eventually he thought it was a good idea. Then I had to convince all the people involved in The Promise to let me on the set. That wasn't the easiest thing.
Last thing before we split, and that is, I just heard that Jonathan Demme died today.
I just read that too. I mean, he's one of the amazing. I mean, he's one of the greats. I didn't even know he was sick. Was that common knowledge that he was sick?
I don't think it is, actually, because it's almost understandable. You still want to be productive and be able to do your work and be productive and all that. And I could see why he might have been motivated not to share that information.
Obviously, one of the great filmmakers of our time in both narrative and documentary. I mean, Silence of the Lambs is one of the greatest movies ever made. I admire him immensely. We both were very involved in the Jacob Burns Film Center, which is up in Pleasantville, New York, and so I know how caring and committed he was to like helping young people make films. And you know, it's just tragic. I mean, a real loss for the community.
All right. Well, thank you.
We're going to talk again?
Yeah, for sure. And you don't have to ask twice.
Hey, good to speak to you again. And I look forward to speaking to you once again in the future.
Me too.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you. Josephine Decker is an actress and a director. Let's see, how many films up to date has she directed? Quite a few. Quite a few. She first came onto my radar. I saw her in a couple of Joe Swanberg movies. Then I was cast in a movie, a very low-budget indie film a few years ago, where she was also in it. So we had some scenes together, and it was a thrill to act with her because she's very talented. She has directed, let's see, as far as features go, Butter on the Latch and Thou Wast Mild and Lovely. I remember they were both released together back in, I think, 2014. Since then, she's also created a segment in the Collective Unconscious Omnibus, and now she has co-directed this new film. It's a hybrid of a film called Flames with her co-director, who's also going to be in this segment, Zephyr Threlwell. And if that's not enough, she's currently involved in a new film called Movie Number One. I have not seen it yet. We don't discuss it, but it is here on IMDb, so I may as well mention it. She's acted in numerous films, too many to mention here, but I'm just so glad to bring Josephine back on. I think this may be her third visit to the podcast. I did not check, but I'm pretty certain that is the case. My conversation with Josephine Decker and Zephyr Threlwell.
I'm scared. I'm terrified. What are you going to... Don't hurt me.
You're totally peeking.
I'm not peeking.
How would you know
I'm
something
scared.
Was there?
You do...
Go! You close your eyes.
Okay.
You lean back, breathe deep. And then you take that dart and you throw it above you. Mm-hmm. Wherever it lands, that's where we go.
Oh, I love you.
I don't know if I've ever had that feeling with anyone, like where you're making art and you're making life and it feels like anything's possible.
We ride the fickle hand of fate.
Okay, fickle hand of fate. What's my hand,
This is
actually.
Your hand is the fickle hand of fate.
Oh, is this a performance piece?
I don't think it's a performance piece.
What is fucking wrong with you? Are you always going to be this difficult?
As I get older, I'll be more of a dick.
More? Like, I can't tell if you're being real right now. Are you really? Did it really?
I mean, as real as it gets.
I want you to say you're right.
Here, I'll make you a deal. I'll say you're right and mean it if I get to slap you.
You're gonna mean it?
Get up, I know you're just fucking around.
Can you have a conversation without walking away?
I don't bounce back as fast as you.
I hated that trip. Fucking asshole.
Get up, I know you're just fucking around. Enough, enough, it's all an act, isn't it?
It's an ad. What
sound check?
Yeah, it's we're already going.
Oh, okay.
So what, it's an ad for distressed jeans?
It is how they distress jeans, right?
Yeah, oh, how they do it.
Put them on a mannequin and then sandpaper them, but it is one of the most kind of luscious and sensual things I've ever seen. It's like somebody caressing a pair of jeans with sandpaper.
Well, they were using for the longest time, they were sanding, they put them on, small Asian children. And they were sanding them, and then it just, they got into all sorts of trouble.
Oh, big trouble. Nike. Yeah.
Because somebody, yes, exactly. And then finally they said, because they're humanitarians, they said, oh, this isn't right.
You should buy Adidas.
We should have thought of that. Yeah, so the reason I do that, because this can make noise. Are you going to be on your phone?
All tickets go through Yermo. Sorry.
Oh, what does? You're not, Josephine, you don't have to say anything. You're so, you just, she's been on.
Oh, please, girl.
Wait, did Ashley leave? No, she's staying, right?
No, she left. I asked her to go. No. What it's funny, because on the way, I got a flurry of emails from young Guillermo, and he said, first, do you mind if Ashley, who shot the. Exactly. And I have that in a newsletter. I could just blast him, like me and you're barely dressed in most of the film, actually. But anyway, he said, "Could you include? Bless you. Could you include Ashley?" And then by the time I read it, there was another email saying, "Forget it. She's got to go." So that was the quickest cancellation. But truthfully, when you're doing this audio thing, more voices is really not better. Even though I wouldn't have probably said no, but because I'm I don't want to reject.
Did she leave?
She did. She had something to do. That's what I heard.
Should I take on a different voice then to be her?
You could do that. Yeah. I have a feeling you could do different voices.
We could get in a lot of political trouble.
Uh-oh. You know, I can't do, like, I could do a French accent, I could do an Italian accent or anything, but which is acceptable. But if I do an Indian accent, people get very, very offended. I'm like, what's the difference between one accent and another?
Do we really want to go there? We can go down that rabbit hole.
Okay.
I don't know what you mean, man.
Great what French accent.
About? Okay.
That's not bad. That's not bad. Where did you go in this film, Flames? Where did you
Maldives.
Go? It's the only place, which is, I know, is sinking.
The lowest country in the world. It's only 2 feet above sea level.
2 feet?
And it's sinking fast.
I know.
Yeah.
Is it sinking or is just the water rising?
Ocean rising.
The ocean rising. Okay.
Half full, half empty.
Exactly. In this case, it's all empty.
That great quote that somebody
horrible.
Was like, I don't see the glass as half full or half
empty. See, half is...
It's this glass is piss.
Oh, I didn't. I used to have a line for that, but I want to talk about the film.
We filmed in New York, the Maldives,
yes.
Sri Lanka, Italy, Germany, and Mexico.
I wasn't there for Italy, Germany, or Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We're very sorry about that.
So let's go back in time. Who's conceived of this film?
Well,
I mean, truthfully, is this really based on a real relationship? Let's be honest.
So Zeffrey was reading Madame Bovary, and he really identified with the main character.
Okay.
And it's been a while since I read the book, so I'm trying to remember who, you know, it was besides. But so anyway, so he had this idea that we would slowly, over the course of 8 months, recreate the story of Madame Bovary on film. The trouble was that I think I didn't brush up on the book before we started shooting, and I think he had read it way too long ago. So we just ended up making kind of a documentary about ourselves.
It's actually really a tragedy that we didn't read the book better.
Well, it's in French.
My French is impeccable, by the way, which is, you know, twice the shame.
Well, on the subject, you know, I stopped reading. I used to read all the classics, and I would read the Russians and the French, you know, like Balzac and...
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Balzac. I said Balzac. I knew where he was going. Should have known immediately.
There's been a plane going by.
Honoré. No, but all the great... And then I stopped doing it at one point because I'm realizing I'm not reading the originals. I'm not reading those authors. I'm reading...
Translations.
Other people's ideas of what those authors wrote and meant. So I just figured that's not... I don't want to do that.
Very smart way to start the interview, right? Because this is really what you're watching here is a meta lens through which you watch our relationship. You know, that people have said, oh, you know, it's really you guys, you know. Mm-hmm. But in a way, it is, of course. But then it's filtered through this woman, Ashley Connor, the best DP in the world, who sacrificed a great portion of her life to be in an emotional three-way with us.
Wow.
And over 5 years.
Long, bad translation of Madame Bovary, in other words.
Maybe better, though. We can't remember Madame Bovary. Nobody remembers Madame Bovary.
Dies. That's what I really remember.
I think she does. Yeah, she's walking across the street reading Anna Karenina and gets run over or something like that. Another book where...
I heard it was stampeded.
But
same.
Ashley, by the way, is invited to come back, to come on. I want to just say that. So
great.
It just looked a little perturbed at me.
There's a coat right there, which makes me think she's going to show back up at some point.
Yeah, maybe. So maybe she'll walk in on us. That's fine with me. I don't care. Anyway. So how did you guys meet?
Okay. All right.
You finish his sentences for me.
Josephine Decker.
Because I've known Josephine a long time, and I don't remember you.
Hey, I'm nobody, so right? That's right. Josephine, I first heard about because she took off all her clothes and crashed a Marina Abramovich performance.
Yeah, I remember.
In MoMA. And I love to show my weenie in public, right? Mm-hmm. That's how I make my money, is a public exhibitionist who, you know, molests anyone who will get near. And so it was a natural fit. I met her on a rooftop party. I tried to throw her over the edge. She scrambled back, and I was like, this girl's got something.
What do you mean you scrambled?
This was ironic, actually. It was my ex-boyfriend's going away party. He was moving to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
I had dated him off and on for 6 years, and then... Zeffrey showed up at that party, and we started talking and, I don't know, hit it off, as they say. Yeah, and I do remember you dragging me towards the edge of the roof. Anyway, I should have known then that it was not going to be a good relationship. But, and actually, you know, it's funny because I remember that the first time we had a date, we went for a picnic in Washington Square Park.
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately was calling us a couple, and he was like, we're going to do these things together and this and this. And he just had no fear and no reservations like believing. Yeah. He just was like, I believe we're going to work and it's going to be amazing. And I was like, wow, I just met you. Cool. You know, and maybe you have to be an idiot to like get on board with something, you know. Yeah. I think maybe now I'd be like, what projection of your fantasy am I, you know? But actually I think, it's really refreshing. That's the thing I really still appreciate about Zephyr, is that he has unbridled enthusiasm about when he has an idea, he believes in it 110%, which at times can be annoying or aggravating, but it is the opposite of most people who are just filled with self-doubt and don't do their ideas. So very inspiring / sometimes I want to kill him.
Right. Well, what is that masking? What is that unbridled enthusiasm or...
Well, I would say,
like, do you not set up yourself up with some sort of hurt? I don't know. Like, you just run right for the finish line.
Is that what Adam, I love you. This is great. Okay, yeah. What is that masking?
So first of all, I would say that I was really in love with Josephine. Right.
I believe you.
This part is makes unbridled enthusiasm and passion very easy. Right. Mm-hmm. You find the person that you're like. You get me. And I get you. And then immediately after
You didn't mean me right now. Sorry. you're talking about her. No. But you do have that with people that aren't necessarily romantic.
Absolutely.
Lovers, too.
I feel like you and I have been friends already for a long time.
Thank you.
You're like, I guess.
I see a picnic in my near future.
Union Square, though. A little something uptown.
But, I only mean it because, you guys are not a couple, so, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't take risks, leaps of faith, or believe in your, you know, instincts, all that kind of stuff. So, but on the other hand, you also are probably old enough to have,
know better.
Yeah, or just know. I don't know.
I think that you asked a great question, right, that I was sidestepping. And that is, of course, it masks fear, right? There's only one thing to mask is fear. And whether or not I was emotionally honest with Josephine, right? I think I was as emotionally honest as I could be with her, which speaks more to, like, you know, kind of a stunting in my own growth, right? And this is the thing I love about... not only the film, which has chronicled a small part of it, but our continued relationship is watching each of us become more able to be honest with the other person, right?
You know, it's such a great question. Like, what is it masking? Mm-hmm. It just makes me think, like, okay, so we're all masking something. I mean, I'm just going to take this full on into the therapy realm, because that seems like maybe more appropriate than talking about the movies for us to just have a little therapy session right now. That would be a real response piece to the
checkbook.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. Anyways, we'll have to pay you later, Adam.
This one's pro bono.
Oh, thank you. I was thinking how in my current relationship, I'm in a really awesome relationship with a very talented human. Feel very safe and comfortable with him. The only thing that we argue about is space, because he keeps his house very clean. I might call it OCD clean.
Oh, boy.
And I am a giant mess. And so when I'm on the outside of him, I'm like, your OCD cleanliness is masking your desire for whatever, power control, you know, whatever. But I think someone could very easily, and I'm like, of course, I'm like, well, I put my mess all over the floor. I have nothing to hide. My mess is everywhere. And like, maybe the thing that I'm masking is like that I have a desire to control other people's spaces with my shit. Mm. Never actually even thought of that before. But now that we're sitting here talking about like, what is the thing that you're masking? Like I have a lot of shit and I love to put it everywhere. Right. And it makes me feel like I'm then in that space and I have some ownership over that space or power of that space. And it's interesting too to think about that then, of course, in terms of the film, So in the film, we're really, we show a lot of ourselves. I'm like, what does this kind of level of oversharing, because you might call it extreme oversharing, what is that masking for both of us? Like, I think, what I think of, like, okay, why do I need to make a movie that's like this? Why do I want it? Why did I let Zephyr put my image in? Because ultimately he had Final Cut, and in some ways I pushed to not have this film made, and then eventually said, okay, yeah, you know, do your thing. I think there was some level of, like, wanting to be seen, you know, like, and also maybe even be seen by Zephyr, because that was something I don't know that we had when we were dating. Somehow being seen by you and being seen by a giant audience of 500 people. I don't know. Maybe that's accomplishing something. So I don't know. What do you think your presence or work on this movie is masking, or now that we're taking this to the therapy level?
I mean, Josephine is a genius, right? In many ways, one of the most brilliant people I've ever met, storytelling wise. And also very well spoken and beautiful and smart and funny, right? The whole package. And so I think that I would mask being intimidated by her with some good bluster, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah, I can give a great show when intimidated. And this is something I always think about with Andy Kaufman, was one of my favorites, right? I love the Kaufman. He could outweird anyone, right? And in this way, you really end up in a different power dynamic, right? Take, for instance, you're on the train, right? A tough guy gets on the train, everybody's like, asshole, right? A crazy man gets on the train, everybody's like, I'm going to move cars.
I always just, well, I don't do that, but.
You don't move when the guy starts swinging his arms around and talking to himself and sitting down on you?
Depending.
Somebody shits their pants in public?
Yeah.
You're not going to stand by that guy.
No. Probably not. It's true.
But maybe on a weekend.
But the tough guy, that's... Yeah. Like somebody. I've stepped my ground. It's true. Yeah. Like I, you know...
Wait, are you the tough guy?
No.
Are you blocking the doors?
Oh, that guy. No, not quite.
What kind of guy doesn't step aside on public
transport? I'm a little bit... Yeah, I get into... the more confined a space I get into, the more unlikable I become. It's true.
Well, we're in a small room now, and I love you.
Well, thank you. And I love you, too. I feel so cheap and... This is going off the rails.
Are there any rails to begin with?
No, you're right. I guess your relationship on the screen, and then there's also, you know, your relationship with the audience, because you are bearing all off. And I got another 20 minutes. We're good. Another 20 minutes. Yeah. Nah, 20. I think they paid already.
Oh my God, I'm about to come.
Well, this is why, no offense, this is why it's very difficult to do.
Press.
Junkets and all. I tend not to, because I don't really do that type of, you know.
Short form.
Yeah.
You have to get in with your not very deep question, and I can tell that you like
no,
to
but
give
it's
the
good.
Deep
this,
questions.
But you know, this is part one.
Yes, yeah,
actually,
right?
I would love to continue talking to you, because you, in a matter of a few moments, have cracked open something that we've never talked about.
Well, I'm glad if I did nothing else.
Ever heard Zephyr say that you were intimidated by me?
Wow.
Cool.
Well, thank you for sharing. I mean, the film is an overshare of sorts, but it's also really, I mean, it's so much fun. It's like this. I use this word only in the best sense. Mess.
Pedophile.
I know that Zephyr has hung out with Owner. That I do know.
Oh, you've hung out with Owner?
He's must have. You must have. No, okay. Don't ever put them in the same room, then.
Yeah,
it's like
you know
that's
that
like
I love men who have strange. What's no filter?
No filter.
Is this onerous man has no filter?
None whatsoever.
No, opposite of Is Flames, which is, I assume, what the relationship went down in, Is that right? It's here at Tribeca. It's obviously the New York premiere, but is this the U.S. premiere? Is this the world premiere? What is it?
This is a world premiere.
World premiere.
Yeah.
That's great. So this is pretty wonderful.
Cool. Yeah, it's been very cool. And I think we're going to learn about ourselves in this process. You know, you put yourself into the world in a way that's vulnerable, and then you discover something new.
I feel like you have been our father figure, our teacher preacher, the one to show us the way.
Well, if I've helped even in a little bit, I feel good.
You know, it's funny because I kind of quit making documentaries because I felt that they were exploitative. But the thing that I forgot that I also figured out when I was making documentaries was that the process of putting yourself on film is the process of also seeing yourself more clearly. And that is, I think, terrifying for anyone. And it can feel exploitative. It's also extremely revealing and allows you to grow. So I think I'm going to be growing a bit now that this film is out in the world. And I think Zephyr already went through a shit ton of growth in the process of dealing with our hundreds of hours of footage.
Yeah, the mirror is a son of a bitch, man. Nobody gets you like the mirror, right?
You're a deep fellow. I'm afraid we're out of time.
Oh.
So,
to be continued.
I was pretending there was a clock up there. I was like, you know, the therapist. I'm afraid the clock's always out of the view of the patient. What was that? Was that 20 minutes? Hold on. It's just barely 20 minutes. You came in to try to cut me off at like 18.
Somebody's in trouble.
Fight.
All right. That's, I slept. Okay, guys, come out and see. Sure, yeah. And up last, if that weren't enough, Oren Moverman. This is a guy who has had his hand in so many wonderful films as either a director, writer, producer. And I feel compelled to name them because he has such a great track record. As a, as a writer, he has written Jesus's Son, I'm Not There, The Messenger, Rampart, Time Out of Mind, Love and Mercy. That's right, he wrote that. Junction 48 and most recently The Dinner. Most of those he's directed, including The Messenger, Rampart, Time Out of Mind, The Dinner, and next, Berlin, I Love You, which I assume is one of the segments, since that's in that series of films, taken omnibus films. There was Paris, I Love You, and New York, I Love You, and maybe Tokyo? I'm not sure. But anyway, Berlin, I Love You, I guess, is next. As I mentioned, this is Oren's second visit to the podcast, and this was a great joy. The name of the movie, again, is The Dinner. I believe it is currently in theaters. It is currently in theaters. I believe it's playing at the Landmark Sunshine Cinema here in New York City and at the AMC Empire 25, as well as at the AMC Lowe's Lincoln Square 13. That's just in New York. Go see The Dinner and have a great time. It's a fun movie to watch. Steve Coogan is in it with Richard Gere. They play brothers. What could be better than that? Well, my conversation with Oren Moverman may be up there.
I'm not going.
Oh, it takes 3 months to get a reservation to this place.
I just don't want to be with these people.
It sounds super exclusive and sexy, like going to France.
During the German occupation, maybe.
Hold on, Congressman.
What is going on?
It's a family matter. It's private.
You are running for governor. Nothing is private.
This is private and it will stay private. After tonight, it'll all be over.
Mr. and Mrs. Lohman have not arrived yet.
Oh, yes, we have. You want to see our driver's license? I'm his brother.
Of course. Right this way.
I'm the only person in my family that cares about real people. Stan, running for public office. Elitist, self-serving, just like mother raised him.
You look good, Paul.
Not as good as my brother, but then I don't spend quite as much time in makeup.
Hello?
Dad? You on my phone?
Yeah, I must have thought it was mine.
This is long overdue. We're going to talk tonight. I'm going to put it all on the table.
seems appropriate.
Here, cheers to your new film.
Thank you.
Which is called The Dinner, appropriately having a glass of wine. There was lots of wine imbibed at the titular meal.
Yes, it's quite a bit of drinking in the movie.
Yes, it seemed like all the characters, except for maybe Rebecca Hall, who is the wife of Richard Gere's character, who is a congressman running for governor, right? Mm-hmm. Just correct me, because mistakes never make it in anyway. It doesn't matter. I could call you.
Totally
I could go call you Owen through the entire podcast.
Some people
podcast,
do.
I bet. But you wouldn't hear it on my podcast. Anyway, Oren Moverman, back on Film Wax Radio. Yeah, we did meet for Time Out of Mind, which had some obscure actor in the lead role, who returns for the dinner. He's become your, I guess, avatar, your muse. What do you? What Richard Gere and you now sort of have this ongoing.
Yeah, Richard Gere and I have worked together on 4 films now. I'm not there. Where
is that
I was,
right?
Yeah,
4
different in different capacities. Lovely. I was a co-writer on I'm Not There. I wrote and directed Time Out of Mind. I produced Norman. And,
oh, okay, that's right.
And now The Dinner.
Very
so,
nice.
Yeah,
were you present on the set a lot during Norman? I haven't.
Yeah.
I have to see it. I already missed a few screenings.
It's out already.
It is out. Okay. Did it come out last Friday, a week ago Friday or something? Okay.
Exactly.
That's what I missed that particular week. Mm-hmm. I usually try to read all the reviews, you know, so I have a sense of what's out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it helps me remember everything. And but it looks like a great satire.
It is, among other things, yes.
And another kind of a little bit more stretching for Gere, it looks like, too.
Yeah. No, he plays a macher.
Right.
And a loser.
Yeah.
Very, very different from his persona.
For those who don't know, because, well, first of all, you're Israeli, but even if you weren't, macher is not in the most unusual term for somebody who is a maker. A maker, like somebody who essentially connects people with whatever they need to be connected with. He's the go-to guy, right?
Exactly. I mean, he's kind of a fixer, a guy who's selling you something and trying to connect the
people. You definitely
people.
You have to have a heavy salesman character, right, to kind of do that type of
work. Yeah, exactly.
But we can mention it's currently in theaters. But now The Dinner here at Tribeca Film Festival, where it is having, I'm going to guess because it's been at Cannes, so... This is, of course, not the world premiere, but maybe it's the U.S. premiere. If it isn't, it's certainly the New York premiere.
No, it's it was in Berlin, actually, but the North American premiere.
North American premiere, yes. Since it wasn't a TIFF, we can say that.
Exactly. Bring Canada into it.
What was it getting at? Oh, I was saying, just not to leave any little things unclosed, but I was mentioning this dinner, and there seemed to be an embarrassment among the characters. This is an apologist kind of thing about all the trimmings and the because this is one of the fanciest restaurants that exists, right? And it's only for the 1%. I mean,
yeah,
go to dinner
it feels like the 1% of the 1% go there. It's a restaurant. Well, we made it up so we could take it as far as we wanted to. It's an empty mansion in Yonkers that we dressed up to be part restaurant, part art gallery, part lounge. The idea was to bring it to the edge of ridiculousness and pull it back just a little bit so it's credible enough but still kind of absurd.
It does feel like that because like Norman, it feels like it's just also the movie overall is just teetering on satire as well, but it's not. It's in the sense that these very outlandish incident almost over the top as well, although you could see it happening, occurs as the sort of backdrop to this dinner that takes place just before the dinner.
Yeah, absolutely. There are over-the-top elements to it. This is, you know, the movie is based on a book, The Dinner by Hermann Koch. goes back to the macher.
Is that true?
I can say
is
that. Else? he's Dutch.
Okay. Oh, he's Dutch.
Yeah, you know, they have the
by way of Israel.
But he's a very famous Dutch novelist. I haven't heard of him before. I was, given this book. But his book, even though I don't read Dutch, but from what I've read about it, is definitely a satire. There's definitely elements to it that are satirical, that are poking fun at the Dutch bourgeois, and that's sort of where he's coming from. Obviously, when you adapt something like that to the United States, you sort of have to decide tonally where you want to go. And we chose to go in a more sort of dramatic, borderline, psychological thriller kind of... direction, but there are definitely still elements of satire in it. And the restaurant is a big part of that. The restaurant is a very civil, environment to discuss a very savage act.
That again forms the backdrop, which I don't think we need to talk about it, because it's sort of it's nice if people go into it
absolutely, and if they're
not knowing this other bit of information, I think that's just optimal. Yeah. Optimal, but
but let's just say that there are teenagers in this story
right.
who do a very bad thing,
right? And that Gear again, as we said, is a politician running for higher office, and his wife is played by Rebecca Hall, second wife.
Yeah,
because in flashbacks we meet his first wife, played by Chloe Sevigny, and his brother, played by Steve Coogan, the great Yiddish actor. I think he would like to be described as that, but a great British comedian and actor. I tell you, Oren, would like another episode just to talk about what it might be like working with him.
But I would do it. You want to do an hour talking about Coogan?
Okay.
We can do the trip about Coogan.
Exactly.
Trip to New York.
Which, since you brought it up, is also at Tribeca, the trip to Spain, the third installment.
Yeah. He's a busy guy.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, they pull off this, they play brothers. Obviously, they're middle-aged men. And Coogan's character, remind me of his name, because...
Paul Lohman.
Thank you. Paul. What's his last name?
Lohman.
Oh, right. He's mentally ill. I mean, that's okay to say, right?
Of course.
So
it is.
It's
okay to say in movies, and it's okay to say in life. He has mental health issues.
Identifying him as such is the question. Not that in and of itself there's anything to be embarrassed about, because some of my best friend's best friends are mentally
right. But I think you hit on something that's at the core of this conversation. Sorry for interrupting, but I think that's really important.
Yeah.
Because so much of and maybe you were leading in that direction, but that's. So much of what the movie is about the issue of mental health and the issue
sure.
of talking about it and destigmatizing that conversation. It's without getting too much on my soapbox, because it's not an issue movie, but in a world when one out of four, one out of five, depending on what statistic you look at, people in the world is suffering from some sort of mental health disorder, it is remarkable how much we don't talk about it, and how much we, even though we have... Every single one of us has either issues or issues with someone in the family, or someone who's close to. Obviously, everyone is kind of fighting a great battle in this life, and there are consequences and there are mental health implications. And somehow, in this particular family, the Lohmans, quite characteristically, they're not talking about it. And when they try to, it's very sort of carefully and without really ultimately taking any kind of sincere action about it. And I think that the mental health issues that Paul Lohman is dealing with, and you can say his mental illness, kind of overtake the movie and bring it to its kind of tragic, kind of sort of abstract ending.
Well, we're talking about mental illness, and we may as well bring in Time Out of Mind into it too, then, because not only is Richard Gere in it, but he plays a mentally ill person in that film, which was your last directorial film.
Yes.
So is that a coincidence?
No, but let me sit on the couch and start this session.
Right. Where we are in a hotel room, by the way. We're set up this.
No, I'm quite proud to take the couch and have therapy here. But I do think that it's not a coincidence. I think that mental health issues somehow work their way through the four movies I directed so far, and in some of my other work as a writer as well. Love and Mercy, to me, The Messenger is obviously about bereavement and PTSD. I think Rampart, which is a police corruption, LA police corruption movie, has at its core Vietnam and the PTSD that mm-hmm. came from that. I think that everyone's suffering from something, and as someone who gets the privilege to write about it and sometimes mm-hmm. direct it, I'm quite drawn to... the pain and suffering that mm-hmm. we deal with in life, and how we communicate it and what it looks like, and ultimately can it lead to compassion and conversation.
One thing about Richard Gere's character, the other Lohman, is just going to guess his name
Stans. here.
Correct.
Thank you.
Stan Lone. It says right
I
here.
Believe
on
I remember.
Gross notes, right. And that is, he does have this streak of compassion. He, so even though it's you think you're walking into this dinner as an you know, audience member watching the film, where Stan Lohman is going to be cutthroat, very, very ambitious to the degree of, you know, even where, as most people at that level, put career first. And you think he's like that. But he surprises you. I mean, it totally doesn't go down that path at all. There seems to be a great deal of compassion for both this teenager event, as we put it, and for his brother.
Yeah, that's something that actually the book did very well, which is set up these characters and feed into your perception pretty quickly. You're gonna like Paul in a book. He's the guy who pokes fun of all these pretentious things. You know you're gonna dislike Stan because he's a politician and we don't like politicians. You feel Claire is kind of level-headed and sensitive and sensible, and you feel like that's going to go all the way through. And in the book, Barbara is actually one person. I sort of divided
that right?
role. Yeah, I divided that role into
two
first and second wives.
Interesting.
Because this is America. This guy would be on his second wife by now.
At least.
At least, exactly. But I think that, you know, that's part of the pleasure of the book and in telling this story also as a film, is you start in one place and you think you know who these characters are. By the end of the movie, they're not even close to what you thought in the beginning.
True. Also, you get a sense that Stan potentially, and again, I'm at a disadvantage. I haven't read the novel, but you get a sense that perhaps he feels, you know, they're before the grace of God go I, because that's his brother who's suffering mental illness. I mean, he sees he dodged a bullet in this. They were brought up together.
Yeah.
It just occurs to me. I don't know. You know.
I think that's true. The way he describes it in the movie, it's a little different from the book, but the way he describes it is he's always had to be the grown-up. He's always had to be the big brother to his brother because his brother was, quote-unquote, strange and had problems. His parents were kind of checked out and or really kind of extreme in their behavior. So it feels to me, and it felt to Geer, I think, in developing the role, that he's somebody who's always had to be the adult, always had to think big, always had to plan ahead, always had to be the politician of the family. And the diplomat. And so in life, that's what he became. And that he is driven by love of his brother on a certain level. But also that love, as we know, a lot of times is really responsibility. Just a mission that you feel as the older brother in a troubled family, that this is your job.
Sure, right, of course, because you were in a lot of times raising, you know, but to some degree, your brother, a younger brother. But again,
that's where you're right. He's looking at him, and part of taking care of him and being responsible for him is the feeling that he was the unlucky one who was inflicted, you know, infected or whatever the word is in that limited lexicon that they have, and he is the one who sort of came away scot free, and so there's a certain element of guilt and a certain element of, you know, there but for the grace of God.
You described it as a thriller. If I hadn't read that in the, you know, I think in the description, I wouldn't have thought of it as a thriller. I mean, in a sense that I guess I understand the tension, the incident that we watch, and it's certainly horrific, this other part of the story. But also, and I hope I'm tantalizing, whetting their appetite so they go see. You should see all Oren films because they're all really so. There's a lot of tension in your stories, and so they're gratifying to watch.
Thank you.
You know.
Thank
you. So it's I find that the description of thriller kind of, but maybe that's a smart way to market the film too.
Honestly, it didn't come from a marketing perspective. It really came from the way I think about it because.
Right.
It's not a classic thriller, and it's definitely not a conventional thriller. What I think the movie does is, you know, by being divided into courses, just like the book, it really divides the narrative into courses and actually creates several films within the film. And I think each one of these films has a wide array of genres and ingredients and spices, and you know where I'm going with all this.
Yeah.
It is the meal itself. You know, the movie is the meal.
Right.
Not only that, the movie is the meal, if you want to get really pretentious, which I do all the time, the meal inside Paul's head, which means that at a certain point, this entire construction that is very well calibrated is going to fall apart. And in the middle of the movie has a nervous breakdown.
Yeah,
you can attribute it to the characters having a nervous breakdown. But the way I thought about it, the way we thought about it as filmmakers, is really let's take this movie and have it fall apart. And not fall apart from a critical perspective, which could be the criticism, but fall apart from in terms of narrative. Can we have a movie that is now going to be suffering the same ailments that the character is suffering from? And we tried it. We tried it. You know, whether it works or not, that's for you and your listeners to decide. But, you know, we went deep into this idea that the movie has its own character and its own life and its own combination of elements. And part of it is, as you said, satire. Part of it is drama. Part of it is elements of a thriller that I feel are not used in a traditional way or in a cynical way, but are just dropped into that because, well, we could talk about, you know, what is a thriller. But that tension and that release and the consequences of a horrible action, I think, are elements of a thriller.
Sure.
So all these ingredients are put in and mixed up, and that becomes what the movie is.
I'm not going.
No, it takes 3 months to get a reservation to this place.
I just don't want to be with these people.
It sounds super exclusive and sexy, like going to France.
During the German occupation, maybe.
Hold on, Congressman.
What is going on?
It's a family matter. It's private.
You are running for governor. Nothing is private.
This is private and it will stay private. After tonight, it'll all be over.
Mr. and Mrs. Lohman have not arrived yet.
Oh, yes, we have. You want to see our driver's license? I'm his brother.
Of course. Right this way.
I'm the only person in my family that cares about real people. Stan, running for public office. Elitist, self-serving, just like mother raised him.
You look good, Paul.
Not as good as my brother, but then I don't spend quite as much time in makeup.
Hello?
Dad? You on my phone?
Yeah, I must have thought it was mine.
This is long overdue. We're going to talk tonight. I'm going to put it all on the table. Toast?
To the children. To health.
To getting through this dinner in one piece.
Cheers.
Hi, love, it's Mom. Your father doesn't know about tonight, and I'd like to keep it that way. Nobody will ever find out if we just keep cool.
Dad? Are you just on my phone? Who are you talking to?
So what's the subject at hand? You know what it is.
It's about the boys.
How much do you know?
How much do you know?
He's gonna turn us in, man. He's gonna turn us in, I know.
These boys have committed a horrific crime.
It was an accident.
This case will never be solved, but is that what we want?
These are good boys. What's done is done.
I'm suspending my campaign. I'm going to set a press conference. Go public. As a family.
You make a decision like this, you also decide the future of my son.
Families will do anything to protect each other.
I am trying to protect you. Because I love those kids. And I love you.
What will he become if he gets away with this?
To get back to Richard Gere, it seems as though be a part of this intention to deglamorize himself to some degree, or maybe to get away. He has so many years as the leading man, and, you know, I mean, he certainly could be doing it much the way that a very small handful of actors before him, you know, Redford and a few others have been able to go for decades. But it seems like he's intentionally trying to become a character actor, or maybe he always was, and maybe he just got distracted because of his good-looking, face
and physique.
And physique and his
and
lean.
And everything else. And,
yeah,
and
his, the great amount of charisma that he has.
I think you're absolutely right. I think he was always an actor. I know that he was always an actor. I mean, this guy started on stage. You know, his big role was
Well, I remember when Bent. I was a kid, Bent came out. Yeah. I remember my mom and sister went to it. Wasn't it like the first theatrical performance that dealt with homosexuality.
Homosexuality,
but it wasn't
the Holocaust.
Oh, during the Holocaust. Sorry. Yeah. But I do remember that they had a love scene where they didn't touch. I remember that being a very famous moment.
Yeah, and it was written by the great Martin Sherman.
So it was during the Holocaust. That's
yeah,
okay.
Exactly. And I think Richard.
There's another instance of I have to fix the because it's been 35 years or more since that came out.
Yeah, well,
about 35 years.
You've
ago.
Watched a lot of since a lot of the things since, so you know. It's,
yes,
it's
right.
Not a surprise.
No, very true. I haven't thought about it, but it was groundbreaking. That I do know.
It was groundbreaking. Yeah. Richard was right there in the center of it, and not only
Davis. What was his co-star in that? I don't remember. Do you remember? Nobody remembers.
No.
And it was probably one of the great stage actors of the day. But Richard Gere was the breakout. You know, he was like this guy who just did Looking for Mr. Goodbar, and then all of a sudden he's.
I want to say that maybe Ian McKellen did it in England.
I was just thinking about. Bruce Davison or one of these great New York actors that is roughly
do a show. Completely dedicated. After we do the Coogan show,
okay,
we're going to do a Ben show and go through the history of that. It's a great play. But Richard's
this is
always
a separate
been
podcast. While we're at it, I guess co-hosted by Orrin Ullmann.
Why don't we just do a series of these?
I would love it.
I would love it too. Actually,
yeah, you should.
Yeah, so
we could just talk about the film and theater and cultural.
I would love that. Whatever culture remains. Yeah. But
Did you see the photos of who was at the White House at this dinner? You know, who was invited? Sarah Palin and Kid Rock and Todd Rundgren.
Not Todd Rundgren. Yeah, the other guy.
Ted Nugent. Yeah. That's right. Not Todd.
Sorry, Todd. Sorry, Todd.
Right, we do have to apologize. I do confuse those names, though.
I do too. I don't know why.
It's weird, right?
It's sort of the same.
Ted Nugent. Yeah.
Todd Rundgren. Yeah. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Going back to Richard Gere, he's always been a serious actor. He's definitely had a career that's quite unique. I don't think he's trying to de-glamorize himself because I actually don't think he thinks of himself in glamorous terms. I think that he is at a stage of his career where he just wants to do good work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are opportunities now for him to do good work that were not there before because basically Hollywood kind of shut down its doors for, anything but these superhero, movies.
Right.
It's not something that interests him as a human being. He is still an explorer. He's a very spiritual man and very much a seeker of deeper things. And I think that he likes, first of all, he likes the speed in which we make independent films.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fast. You can get a lot done very quickly. He has the experience to do it very quickly. And I think he likes to sink his teeth into things that are different. And since Hollywood is not going to come up with that, not just for him, but for most serious actors, he's looking at independence. And how lucky are we that he's actually interested in exploring that route?
The dinner is coming out theatrically, thanks to The Orchard, on
May 5th.
Thank you, May 5th. So it's coming right up. And how is it for you to get a film like this? Because you said there are no capes in this movie, and maybe I missed it. So what is that like? Are you very involved in that part of the process? The Orchard picked it up at, did they do that at Cannes then, I assume?
No, they picked it up
Berlin?
No, actually, you're right, in Cannes.
Okay.
They did pick it up. We had a promo that was showing in Cannes, and they picked it up even before they saw it. They've been tracking it from the script stage. They've been on it from the beginning, and they've been great. It's always a delicate situation. What you want to do as a filmmaker, thank you. Yeah.
Who's that?
This quietly, please. Dining.
Oh, our lunch is here.
Our lunch is here. Our masseuse will be here momentarily.
Oh no, I'm the masseuse.
That was not.
You're in trouble.
How it was explained to me. Okay. Huge lunch. No, that's okay. Just leave it there. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Okay. Yes, sir. Thank you. Enjoy. Thank you.
But continue what you were saying about, distribution. And
yeah, I mean,
because, the idea, like you say, it's hard. Dramatic films they shouldn't.
Yeah.
Maybe they do well internationally. I don't know.
It's hard to tell. I mean, we know that most people don't watch movies in theaters anymore. Well, not most, but a lot of people, and especially
outside of New York.
Yeah.
Because in New York, they're building theaters.
Yeah, in the rest of the country. But, and this movie is opening relatively big for movies I've been involved with for sure. I think, it's always a delicate thing for a filmmaker. How much do you get involved in the distribution side of it? I would have to say that, The Orchards have been very welcoming and very open to the conversation about it. And they keep me, in touch with every decision they make, and they ask for my opinion,
oh, well,
which is
good.
More than you can ask for, period. But
well, as long as you're in this particular sphere, budget-wise and size-wise, I guess that's the advantage, right? That you do have a little bit more say in it. And the human being may actually call you and ask you to look at the poster before they just, you know.
Exactly. And they've been very collaborative that way.
Yeah.
You know, and at the end of the day, it's their movie to bring out into the world because they bought it. So the question of how they're doing it is ultimately trumped by the idea that they truly believe in the movie. Otherwise, they would not go as far as they're going with it. And so that belief is reassuring. Hopefully it pays off to them. You know, I've made the movie. There's not a lot I can do now. You know,
right.
I can talk to you and I can pontificate, but it's their movie to bring into the world. So I'm hopeful for, you know, for their strategy and for the way they approach it. But these are such confusing times when it comes to distribution.
Sure.
Everything's in flux.
It's been that way for a while, and I guess it's staying that way for a while.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is, you know, the last traditional movie release I'll be involved with, or there are more, or I just don't know where things are going.
It doesn't seem like, you know, it just seems like there's been enough years where streaming hasn't replaced the cinema. They continue to build them, and even ones that are art house. I mean, at least in this city, I can say. But so hopefully that's some indication, hopefully, that there's room for the conventional theatricals, and because it seemed to still be a very, very popular idea.
Yeah, I think there is room,
but
I think
festivals,
that with movies like this, it's gonna have to, it's probably older audiences.
Oh, potentially. Yeah, I suppose. But
and cool cats.
Well, you have Steve Coogan in this film and Rebecca Hall. It's got you got quite a few British actors in it now that I think about
just two.
It. Just two. And
Rebecca is half American.
Oh, is she? Yeah. I didn't know.
My mom's American.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'd love to get her on here, too. Well, I asked for Laura Linney, but, you know, I thought that was possible, perhaps, to get Laura Linney on.
Well, the problem, can I tell you the truth? The problem with working with a cast of this level is that once you're done working with them, they're really busy.
Yeah, no, I understand.
They do theater. They're on TV shows. They're making movies, and it's the pleasure of working with people on a really high level is also the disadvantage of trying to find them when you're actually putting the movie
out. It makes sense. Yeah. I understand the way it works, but still feel bad about it. So
we'll bring her on bring her on our podcast once we
With you on, I may actually get somebody like that. It's very true. I do now. I'm in the I'm working for this brand new podcast company. They have three really cool podcasts on. None of them deal in film, but they're once like called Memory Motel, which is about memory. One's called The Lonely Hour, which is about solitude. I'm dealing with helping them, and my whole world seems right now more or less to be involved in podcasting. So I think if there was, even if you did a limited number, you probably really would get
a big
audience.
I would love to do that. I mean, I'm so excited about the world of podcasts. Because
you are? Do you listen to them?
Yeah, because I grew up 100 years ago in a very new country, and all we had was radio.
Right.
I didn't have movies. I didn't have television.
So you grew up watching the radio.
Watching the radio.
Yeah.
And I, to this day, going to a radio station is like the most thrilling thing I could do.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It is, right? It holds a lot of magic. I mean, I'm not always in the studio. So I go through these periods where I have a studio at my access, and, there's nothing like sitting in front of those mics and making that magic,
it's the most thrilling.
I don't think people thought podcasting, they thought, no, you got to have video. But I think podcasting, it really does. People love the ability to have that friendship with the, and that intimacy that forms when you're listening to something.
And because the beauty of the human voice, voice that's in your ear. It's
especially our two voices.
Well, of course, especially our two voices.
I normally don't ask because it's a cliche question, but I actually really am super curious about, that's why you said super first, which is what you're looking at next, because I'm intrigued by all your projects.
Thank you. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I have a few projects that I'm looking at that are, kind of ready or on their way to be ready to direct. But I'm also producing, I'm working with a new company, I'm just really trying to do as much as possible before they stop me, you know, including developing some television.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Because it's apparently that's the thing to do. But yeah, I'm just trying to be as active as possible.
Well, there's a lot of work. I mean, now. Cause
and also I'm heading for a strike, so, you know.
Oh, geez, that's right. Sorry to bring up that.
No.
But,
hopefully we'll avoid it, but yeah, it's a possibility as well.
Sure, sure.
In which case, I'll have plenty of time to do our podcasts.
Listen, I think we're Facebook friends, so you may hear from me. I may pitch you with something. We'll make it super easy. You're in New York?
I was in New York.
You're in New York. So you heard it here. Okay. Well, the lovely Claire Kelleher is giving me the signal, and she gave me lots of time, so thanks. Just go to see The Dinner in theaters May 5th, The Orchard, directed by Oren Moverman, starring Liv Richard Gere, Laura Linney, Rebecca Hall, Steve Coogan, and Chloe Sevigny, and a couple of very young actors whose names don't come to me at the moment, but they'll be the next people on our podcast, too. So. All right, thank you very much, Oren.
Thank you.
Toast?
To the children. To health.
To getting through this dinner in one piece.
Cheers.
Hi, love, it's Mom. Your father doesn't know about tonight, and I'd like to keep it that way. Nobody will ever find out if we just keep cool.
Dad? Are you just on my phone? Who are you talking to?
So what's the subject at hand? You know what it is.
It's about the boys.
How much do you know?
How much do you know?
He's gonna turn us in, I know.
These boys have committed a horrific crime.
It was an accident.
This case will never be solved, but is that what we want?
These are good boys. What's done is done.
I'm suspending my campaign. I'm going to set a press conference. Go public. As a family.
You make a decision like this, you also decide the future of my son.
Families will do anything to protect each other.
I am trying to protect you. Because I love those kids. And I love you.
What will he become if he gets away with it?
By the way, Rooftop Films has announced their 21st season begins next weekend, the 19th. This is what we mean by short films, which will take place at the old American Can Factory in Gowanus, right there on 3rd Street and 3rd Avenue. At 8 o'clock, the doors open at 8:30. Live music by... How do you pronounce that? I can't pronounce it. At 8:30, live music by... And I cannot pronounce this name, so I'm going to just spell it. INNOVGNAWA. No idea. 9 o'clock, the films begin. And then after that, a party sponsored by Corona, Tanqueray, and Fever Tree. You can RSVP now. The films include Nathan Truesdell's Balloon Fest. I just ran into Nathan at the Maryland Film Festival. Followed by Blind Sex, Sarah Santa Maria Merton's short. She's from France. Then Winona Regan's Boss Bitch. And then Flowers, by Nikiatu Jusu and Yvonne Shirley. Then High Stranger, directed by Kirsten Lepore. Leningrad Kolchik, directed by Ilya Neshuler from Russia. Then The Robbery, directed by Jim Cummings and Dustin Hahn. Followed by The Tale of Hillbilly, Darren Rabinovich, Isaiah Saxon, and Sean Helfrich. And lastly, Tickle Monster from the UK, directed by Remy Weeks. Check it out. And then on Saturday, May 20th, at 7 o'clock in the evening, the film is called Band-Aid, the refreshingly real and raw and hilarious feature debut from Zoe Lister-Jones, who is a former guest of Filmwax Radio. It's the story of a couple played by Zoe and Adam Pally, who can't stop fighting. Advised by their therapist to try and work out their grief through unconventional means, I'm just making this now up, They put together a band, I think. Fred Armisen is in it. So it's got to be good. I think he plays the drummer in their little trio band. So they're going to show the film, and then they're going to have a live concert afterwards. Live music from Zoe Lister-Jones and Adam Pally. So I'll be there for that. And that's on the 20th, next Saturday, a week from Saturday. And that will take place at House of Vans, which is at 25 Franklin Street, Brooklyn. That's it. I'm signing off. You've been listening to Filmwax Radio, episode number 406. The podcast is part of the Showbiz Studios Podcast Network, the result of a partnership with Rooftop Films. Till next time, everyone, take care of yourself and the ones you love.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols.